Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How you doing, Brian?
Oh, Sean, I am grinning from ear to ear. I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, you're showing all of your 38 teeth.
You know, I have those big Italian dental genes. How are you doing?
Super as always.
Shawnee, do you know one reason why we're both doing really, really super?
No.
It has to do with a big, round number.
Oh, I know what it is. It's a significant number, isn't it?
It's a significant milestone that has been passed. I don't know, do you ever pay attention to when I post the podcast episodes, how I don't just put the name of the episode, but then I put some, like, weird code? In fact, someone who was new to our podcast just last week said, it looks like an airplane code. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the BA part.
BA. Now, what does that mean when it says BA and then a number?
Babe, it means Broad Appeal and episode number.
Now, for some reason, even from the beginning, I decided to start with BA001. I'm not sure.
Oh, because we're going to go into, what, triple figures? Well, you're thinking.
Well, that was only 2 years ago and some months, but we have now reached it, Sean. This is our 50th episode.
50. Wow.
How do you feel about that?
I feel aged rapidly.
What is the 50th anniversary? Is that like...
It's gold.
Oh, lovely. I love a bit of gold finger. You know, and to be honest, even though this is our 50th named episode, it's actually, we have done far more than that, because the last 8 episodes have had 3 parts. So I think by those calculations, this is like our 74th or 75th episode.
Plus a couple of, like, you know, filler episodes in between, so like 76 maybe.
Yeah, 76 trombones led the big parade. I'm here with all your musical theater song references.
Quick, Brian, get to the window before the parade passes by.
So, it seems to only make sense that for our 50th episode, considering that there's 50 states in the United States of America, we have picked as an actress someone who is perhaps the most quintessential contemporary American. She's as American as apple pie. She's America's sweetheart.
She's American as American racism.
That's not true. She's never demonstrated any racism.
No, but America is racist.
Not even in Steel Magnolias.
Let's just admit that racism is part of your country's heritage.
I'm well aware of that. I'm ready to admit it, but okay, I don't think it has much to do with the woman who is fundamentally a sweetheart through and through for several decades now. Of course, I am talking about Julia fucking Roberts. Now, Sean, you have recently taught me a word that I didn't know before. That word is idioglossia.
And by recently, I think you mean the last 10 minutes or so.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah. So, for the benefit of our less learned listeners, what is an idioglossia?
Well, it's like a stupid language told between stupid people.
Oh, it's not.
Not entirely. It's like...
It's like a private language.
It's like a language that exists, but usually between a couple of people. It's in jokes and certain words that signify certain things and, you know, covert meaning.
So basically, most of this podcast consists of, like, in-jokes and references that we have between ourselves, which we share with the world. I guess you could call that our idioglossia?
Exactly.
Okay, so can you explain to the world why I always refer to her as Julia fucking Roberts?
So on our very first holiday, which was to Portugal, really good holiday, a bit weird towards the end though, but generally very good. Too many sardines, they really went to my head. So at one point we were in the street and I was taking a photo of Brian and I said, could you just, like, give me a different smile, because you use the same smile all the time. And Brian snapped at me in the street and he said, so do you, so does Julia fucking Roberts. And even though he was clearly irate, I found this very funny, because, you know, Julia Roberts does essentially do the same smile over and over again, as does Brian.
It's rare in my life that I consider myself to have anything to do with a fabulously successful, incredibly beautiful woman. However, Julia Roberts and I do have one thing in common, which is that people are constantly commenting on the enormous size of our mouths.
Yes.
Okay. So
I have a huge mouth.
I have a very big mouth, a very toothy smile. I can fit like my entire fist inside my mouth.
Just give me a smile right now. No, smile. Is that really your smile? No, a real one.
Babe, this is not good podcast content.
This is good. It's really not. Make your cheeks go like wider. Yeah, and show me some bottom teeth as well. That's it. Yeah, you got a lot of teeth. That goes in the podcast.
It is weird that we talk about actresses in this way, that we, like, pick them apart and divide them up by their physical attributes, you know? But I do think that Julia Roberts' smile has been commented upon since her very first big arrival on the big screen. I don't know, it's a key to her success. It's one of her most winning and noticeable qualities. Do you agree?
I do, but also I saw a program before that by scientists that said that Julia Roberts shows more teeth when she smiles than the average person does.
This was an entire program about Julia Roberts' teeth. No, it was a segment
in a program.
Oh, okay, okay. So do you think, like, Julia Roberts wouldn't be as successful, she wouldn't be a movie star if she didn't show that many teeth?
I mean, it's hard to know, because watching these three films, which I enjoyed her 100%, I do think she's kind of funny looking.
This is the thing that's so fascinating, I think, about the great movie stars, right? Like, the movie stars of all time, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are not great beauties or traditional beauties. I'm talking here mostly about actresses. Like, certainly if we go back to the 40s and the 30s, right? The real iconic film stars that we remember, Betty Davis, Barbara Stanwyck, Katharine Hepburn, they all have very unusual looks. They're very striking looking women.
Yeah.
And of course, Betty Davis is known for her
sunken eyes.
There must be other actresses who are known for particular physical qualities.
Well, you know, Katharine Hepburn is known for her neck skin.
Eventually, yes. Marilyn Monroe, of course, is known for her figure. Jane Mansfield, like, even more so. I mean, I guess in the 50s you had women who were really known for their bosoms.
Crawford for her eyebrows and weird shoulders.
Yeah.
You know, I think if we listed a lot of actresses, we could say at least one unique distinguishing feature. I mean, you mentioned Barbara Stanwyck. I mean, she barely ever, like, opened her teeth.
And when you think about contemporary movie stars, I mean, like, even someone like Julianne Moore, who is stunning, like, you think of her as red hair and freckles, right?
Yeah.
She is, like, the red-haired, freckled movie star.
Yeah.
I apologize to anyone who thinks we're objectifying these women. I think what we're doing is saying that there's a distinguishing feature that makes them individual. And in many ways, actresses who are sort of the epitome of traditional female beauty with absolutely no distinguishing characteristic, they often don't have lasting appeal.
That's how I always felt about Reese Witherspoon. I'm really glad that Reese Witherspoon has really seriously gone into producing. I've not seen Big Little Lies, but I really want to. But I've always thought that she was so plain, like, such a plain Jane.
Well, but she's sort of, her role is like every girl, right? But then you think of someone even like Audrey Hepburn, who, like, was considered to be so beautiful, but she's like, she looks emaciated some of the
time.
Well,
she was.
Yeah.
She has spent some of her life in a concentration camp.
I know. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, these women who become the truly great movie stars, they do something to kind of change standards of beauty, whereas, like, the women who kind of fall into conventional images of what's beautiful, they might be like pinup girls for teenage boys, they might even win Oscars, but to really have lasting power as, like, style icons, they rarely do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's why I wonder what's going to happen to Jennifer Lawrence at some point.
Mm.
Like, I actually really like Jennifer Lawrence. The more interviews I hear with her, the more I realize that she has absolutely no craft to her acting skill. She has no interest in researching anything she does. She's really fun on screen. I just don't know if she's going to have the lasting power. I really don't.
Well, I think Jennifer Lawrence is a really interesting comparison to Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
Because Julia Roberts, I mean, okay, so she broke into big mainstream stardom right at the end of the 80s, right? Isn't Steel Magnolias is like 1988 or 89?
89, I think.
89. And then, of course, Pretty Woman, like, was a huge hit that, like, centered around her. She got an Oscar nomination. And from then on, she was a mega movie star. She was commanding huge box office salaries. She was opening major pictures. But more so than that, her love life, her red carpet appearances, all of that was fodder for everyone's interest. She was all over People magazine and all those magazines. Like, you don't remember all that, I'm sure, but like the way that Jennifer Lawrence was everywhere for a while, that was Julia Roberts in the pre-internet age.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that my mother knows a lot about Julia Roberts' private life.
Because, oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't. Like, we've established this a few times. I'm a bit younger than you are, Brian. So I kind of really only became aware of Julia Roberts with the film we're about to see today.
Because Julia Roberts now, she's a mom. She doesn't feature in the tabloids all that much for her private life now. I think she's been married stably for quite some time, hasn't she?
Well, when she got with that guy...
Whoever he is.
His name is Mr. Moda.
Okay.
I know that's his surname. So he, I believe, was a cameraman on The Mexican.
Okay.
Yeah, which was like 2001 or something.
But like before that, it was like Kiefer Sutherland. It was the short-lived Marriage to Lyle Lovett.
What's that about?
Yeah. And I think there was definitely a lot of misogyny that was tied up in the way that Julia Roberts was constantly criticized in those years. Like, she was so powerful, so famous, you know. I suspect she got scrutinized in a way that probably the likes of Tom Cruise didn't get scrutinized.
Yeah, this is what I think about Julia Roberts now. Julia Roberts is Hollywood royalty now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if you look at her filmography, you get one film a year. And granted, it's not always the best film. But for example, you know, Money Monster was directed by Jodie Foster and starred George Clooney. It's kind of like, well, here are three big Hollywood hitters working together.
Yeah, okay? and Julia's a member of an in-club. Like,
yeah.
she's worked with, you already mentioned The Mexican, she knows Brad Pitt, she knows Steven Soderbergh, she knows George Clooney.
Yeah.
Like, she's worked with everybody.
And even Wonder, which was the film she was in last year, actually grossed an awful lot of money.
So, even despite that incredibly long success and that Hollywood royalty status, don't you think there's always been this kind of ongoing debate, this big question, which is, can Julia Roberts really act?
I personally have not been part of this debate.
You mean you have never questioned her
ability?
Never
questioned it, no. But the roles that she does are suited for her ability.
But see, even that is an interesting way to phrase it, right?
Uh-huh.
Suited for her ability, meaning that her ability is limited?
This is my opinion on acting, darling.
Go ahead.
Bad acting is Keanu Reeves.
Okay.
Then by that I mean, I have never felt that Keanu Reeves was delivering lines like a human being.
Okay.
You talk about Uncanny Valley. I'm like, what is this guy doing on the screen?
Okay.
So if you say that Julia Roberts is limited, for me, she delivers lines like a human. She smiles where she has to. She walks where she's supposed to walk. That, to me, is acting.
Even, I think, one or two of the people that we've mentioned we were doing a Julia Roberts episode kind of raised a skeptical eyebrow, the same way people do also about someone like Sandra Bullock. Because Julia and Sandra, in terms of their biggest successes, are known for things like romantic comedies and kind of female-driven, less serious pictures, right? They're not the Meryl Streeps. They're not the Jessica Langs who do big, gut-wrenching drama. There is this idea that what they do is flimsy and that they're just kind of cute. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with that, but I think we have to reckon with that opinion as we deal with Julia Roberts. And when you talk about, like, not delivering lines like a human being, you and I did watch the trailers for some Julia Roberts movies that we decided not to include.
Yeah.
I will name a couple of them.
Yeah.
Mary Reilly is one. Michael Collins was another.
Yes.
Okay, so Hook is another one.
Yeah.
Would you agree that Julia Roberts appears to be bad in those movies?
Well, first of all, you know, the people who say, oh, rom-coms, they're snobs, okay?
Yeah.
Total snobs. Secondly, I think she was just miscast in those films. Like, being miscast is not your fault, but maybe Julia Roberts does not have that in her. And the reason I couldn't watch Mary Reilly is because I've seen some of it on TV before, and it is bad, bad, bad.
Who are some actresses that you can kind of envision? Okay, they could probably play nearly any role.
Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep. Not like an action movie at this point. But Meryl can play lots of things.
Cate Blanchett.
Cate Blanchett. She could do action. Yeah,
she can do comedy.
Yeah.
She can do drama. She can do accents.
Jennifer Lawrence, again.
I don't know that I'd plonk down money to see Jennifer Lawrence in a period drama.
Juliette Binoche.
Okay.
Yeah, she can. She can. She was in Godzilla.
Okay. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, when I think of the distinction between actress and movie star...
Yeah.
And actually, this came up in Feud, didn't it?
Yeah, but this is the whole thing about Joan and Betty, was that Betty Davis was the actress and Joan Crawford was a movie star.
So what does that distinction mean to you?
Well, the distinction means that a movie star is never going to make herself ugly. A movie star is never going to take a role that says she is anything other than the movie star we know her to be. Betty Davis, however, always considered herself an actress and very often was ugly or unappealing or difficult or challenging. The best example of this is that in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Joan Crawford, albeit in a wheelchair, she still looks like Joan Crawford, and Betty Davis is a hag.
And I think it's not so much even just about making themselves ugly or unappealing, but it's also about transforming themselves. It's like what you said about craft. Like, when you say Jennifer Lawrence doesn't have a lot of craft, it's like she doesn't have a technique to say, I'm changing myself into this character, you know? And I would say Julia Roberts doesn't really do that very much either, which is why perhaps some of the roles where she seems most miscast are ones where she's playing anything other than all-American woman, like Mary Riley, Michael Collins, Tinkerbell. You know, she's just not in those worlds.
How could someone get Tinkerbell wrong? Can I just point out...
I'd like to see you play Tinkerbell.
I'd be great. Last thing I will say about Julia Roberts in her miscast roles. Julia Roberts has the unique distinction of playing a character from Longford.
What?
Yeah.
Who's from Longford?
The character she plays in Michael Collins. Yeah, she's a real Kitty something or other.
Longford's most famous daughter, Kitty oh something or other.
I think of Kitty Kelly, or no, she's an author, but Kitty something. She's from Longford. Kitty Kelly, did I say that already?
Kelly is your mother's family name. Are you claiming a relation to
this
person?
Don't think so, but she is... She plays a woman from Longford, and that's the best thing about that film.
Well, wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, why something like Erin Brockovich is exactly the right sweet spot for Julia Roberts to prove herself. She can be done up in a kind of drag, of like working class drag, but she's still essentially being feisty, lovable, tough-talking Julia Roberts, but it's enough of a role, enough of a character, with a few ticks and props and costuming things to make us say, oh wow, look, she's really pushing herself, she's stretching her movie star persona, but it's reasonably within the Julia Roberts persona.
But when you watch that film, you cannot come away from it not saying, wow, that was great.
Oh, it's great. Erin Brockovich is great. But
such a great film.
What I'm saying is that is a great movie star performance, right? Yeah. That is not like, how did she do that? That is like perfect combination of role, story, actress. Everything has combined to like give us a winning personality that only that woman could deliver so well. And that is why Julia fucking Roberts is a great fucking movie star.
Yeah. Now, that leads us very nicely to the film that we're going to talk about today.
It's Richard Curtis's screenplay, Notting Hill, directed by Roger Mitchell, and also starring Hugh Grant.
Yeah, I often wonder why we keep the name of the film for ages, considering whoever's listening to this podcast has pressed the button. Do you know what I mean? It's fine, you know.
Well, they might be wondering, so if this is about Julia Roberts Good, why did we pick Notting Hill? Why did we dispense with a number of the other really good, really classic Julia Roberts roles that we could have talked about? So let's just enumerate. We've actually already mentioned most of them.
Yeah.
So Erin Brockovich, her Oscar-winning Best Actress role.
Yeah.
Pretty Woman.
Never seen
it. I've never seen it either.
Shit!
Why did we watch Pretty Woman?
Fuck!
Sorry. Well, it is about a sex worker. I think we would have had to deal with a lot of Me Too stuff. Maybe we're just good enough that we kind of passed that one by.
Yeah, you don't need two men talking about a woman's use of her body.
Okay. Anyway, Pretty Woman, her big breakfast role. Of course, drink the juice, Shelby. Drink the juice. Drink the juice.
Pink is my signature color.
Steel Magnolias.
It was blue by the end of that film.
I was always a fan of Mystic Pizza because I lived so near to Mystic, Connecticut. Why did we decide not to do those for Julia Roberts Good?
I felt they were too obvious. And, like, I think most people already know that Erin Brockovich is great, and that would have been the one that I really wanted to do. And Pretty Woman, I think it's the fact that Richard Gere is in it. That is enough of a turn off for me.
What? You don't like Richard Gere?
I don't like
him. You loved him in Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
I did, but I don't like him. I don't like his face. I don't mind his butt in a jockstrap. But I don't want to see his face.
Only film him from the waist down.
Yeah. You know, when I see Richard Gere, I want him just to be face down, arse up, you know? That's the way I like him.
Calling Sean Cody. Calling Sean Cody.
Well, that's my middle name.
All right. So we settled on Notting Hill. Amazingly, I had never seen this film. You assured me that it was good, so you have seen it before.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us how you came to watch Notting Hill?
So I believe, actually, my sister rented it, or else it was on television. Either way, I watched it in my sitting room with my mother. And the reason why I think this is a good example of Julia Roberts being good is because this is a kind of a meta film about an actress, about a movie star, rather. And so the whole story hinges on the fact that Julia Roberts has the star wattage and star appeal of someone that these characters in the film and both the people at home will go crazy for.
It's a fascinating movie. I think I said earlier this week that it's like the Hamlet of rom-coms.
Wow. Who did you say that to? You didn't say it to me.
I thought I said it to you. By which I mean that it is the most self-conscious rom-com in the sense of being on this meta level about the woman who is starring in it, both commenting on her and using our own self-consciousness of who she is, the real world Julia Roberts, as a kind of engine for who the character that she's playing. So essentially the premise of Notting Hill is that Julia Roberts is a movie star, an American movie star, very much like Julia Roberts, who is named
Anna Scott.
Anna Scott.
Anna Scott.
And she just happens...
Oh my God, Anna Scott.
She just happens to be in that delightful little part of London that's just absolutely like a little village unto itself, does not have high, high property prices that are completely unaffordable to most people, called Notting Hill.
Well, apparently, you know, this film is responsible for the rapid gentrification of Notting Hill. Okay. This?
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah. You know, people could live in Notting Hill at one point affordably.
You know, I heard, actually, that people used to be able to have affordable weddings and funerals before Richard Curtis made a movie called Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Oh, you're funny, aren't you?
So this is the third movie written by Richard Curtis that we have covered on Broad Appeal.
Yeah, he's our most covered filmmaker.
Months. Yeah. Months. It's fascinating because we identified, I think, when we did Love Actually and The Tall Guy, that there is a Richard Curtis sort of premise, and particularly a Richard Curtis male hero, right?
Well, the Richard Curtis trope usually has a relatively successful and financially comfortable male who is handsome but doesn't exactly realize and is very awkward with women, and when it does come to seduction technique, weaponizes this awkwardness into pure, pestering, bothersome, mild harassment. Is that right?
Yeah, I would describe every Richard Curtis male hero as completely hapless,
yeah,
and completely afraid to speak to women.
Yeah.
Infantile. Now, Hugh Grant has been that hero many, many times, and here he is again. Interestingly, here we have two big movie stars, right? Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant. But in this film, Julia Roberts is playing a movie star. Mm-hmm. Hugh Grant, also a big movie star with lots of big tabloid scandals to his name, is playing a, you know, nebbishy guy who just happens to live in Notting Hill and run a travel bookshop.
He owns the bookshop as well. We've gathered that. We've gleaned that.
Right. So I just have to say, like, how do you feel about that as a premise? Like, would you say that Hugh Grant, at this point that Notting Hill's made, is still believable as the kind of average British everyman?
I think this is his last opportunity to play this role convincingly. And by that I mean, I do believe that he's kind of crap, you know, with women and with money and with life. No man in a Richard Curtis film is ever truly at a disadvantage. So you go in there knowing that the conflict is always going to be minimal. Like, Hugh Grant did not have to stave off a property developer at any point. Well, he wasn't a victim of knife crime in this film.
He is. I mean, he is in a dying business, which is an independent
not
bookshop.
In 1998. Come on.
I don't know. When was You've Got Mail?
1999. But that was New York. Okay, that was Manhattan.
Okay.
This is still London, but, you know, gentrification was a word that people didn't even know yet.
But I guess what I'm saying is, like, the plot hinges on him being, quote, normal, just a normal person,
yeah.
And she's a movie star, uh-huh. Yeah? So we have to buy him as not an extremely handsome, debonair guy, but as a kind of flustered every person. And I'm just wondering whether you bought that.
It's a difficult question, because in every role that Hugh Grant is in, you have to buy it enough.
When Four Weddings and a Funeral came out, no one knew who he was.
Yeah, but think of Bridget Jones's Diary, okay?
Yeah.
Did I think for one second that Hugh Grant had ever worked in publishing? Probably not, no. But I kind of went with it, do you know what I mean?
But what's fascinating by the time he does Bridget Jones's Diary
yeah.
is that he's a cad,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's a cad.
And I think part of that Hugh Grant transformation into the cad came about because of the amount that we learned about the real Hugh Grant and his relationship with Elizabeth Hurley and his affair with the sex worker that he was caught, you know, with in L.A., all that kind of stuff. It was, like, no longer believable that this man was just, you know, a kind of doe-eyed innocent,
yeah.
Yeah? Which is essentially what he's still playing in Notting Hill.
Yeah, but this is the last time he does it successfully.
Okay, so it was successful to you. I have to admit that, like, while watching this movie, which is so much about the perils of fame and being a movie star, I could not help but think, I'm watching two movie stars in which one is being a movie star and one is trying to not be a movie star.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's bad, I'm just saying it makes for a really interesting kind of commentary on the film.
Yeah.
Do you want to just quickly explain, like, what the plot engine of Notting Hill is?
Extremely quickly. Anna Scott is super famous. William Thacker owns a bookstore. One day, Anna Scott comes into William Thacker's bookstore. They have the mildest of frissons. Later that day, William Thacker spills orange juice, thankfully not coffee, all over her top. He brings her back to his house where she changes awkwardly. He tells her, quote-unquote, that she is heavenly before she leaves. She kisses him, then leaves, then gets in touch with him again. Long story short, they date, they stop dating, and by the end of it, shock horror, they get together. She
may be the face I can't forget. And the movie, even from the opening credit sequence, begins with what I can only assume is real red carpet footage of the real Julia Roberts arriving at movie premieres and, like, publicity shots of her on the cover of magazines and things like that. And Hugh Grant is giving some kind of Richard Curtis-like monologue about how he's seen her from afar and he just always thought she was fabulous,
yeah.
And just so incredible, and that smile and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and the title music is She by Elvis Costello.
Mm.
It's telling you from the moment it starts, this is all about this woman's success, fame, and beauty.
And how that is essentially the obstacle that's going to come between this couple. Now, you've already kind of elucidated the meet-cute, how they get together in the bookshop and all that stuff, and she's kind of just looking for a travel book, and he's not acknowledging that he knows who she is, but there's, like, somebody else in the shop who rudely asks for her autograph. Okay. Possibly, I believe, that she goes to change her shirt in his house. It's already stretching my credulity. How much am I meant to really believe that this kind of bumbling guy who tells her, quote, that you're heavenly, she just thinks is so incredible and adorable that she just spontaneously snogs him?
Okay, what this film does quite well is that it is actually very slow because it is longer than it needs to be. So there's a lot of awkward, cute build-up,
mm-hmm.
You know, which, and there's a whole scene in that house where he looks in his fridge and he's like, would you like to try some kind of apricot and honey concoction? And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, kill me, I want to die.
I better be going. Thanks for your, help.
You're welcome. And, may I also say, heavenly. I just take my one chance to say it. After you've read that terrible book, you're certainly not going to be coming back to the shop.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, my pleasure.
But the whole point of it is that, like, we have to believe that she is being slowly and incrementally charmed by this loser. And that is what the whole film is slower than the average rom-com. And that is probably its kind of, you know, mode of assassination.
Well, okay, it is and it isn't. So, first of all, I have to say, actually, we've identified another Richard Curtis element, which is an incredibly messy flat and an incredibly idiosyncratic flatmate.
Yes.
Okay, it's always, always features.
Yeah, we saw it in Tall Guy, and was it in Love Actually?
Oh, probably somewhere, and it's definitely in Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah.
So in this case, it's Rhys Ifans as somebody named Spike, who's kind of always walking around in his underwear. I quite loved the really period detail of the magnetic poetry on the fridge, which everyone had at that time. Yeah. So, yes, I agree with you, it builds up slowly, but like in a classic romantic comedy, there's this kind of smoldering tension of will they or won't they, maybe they hate each other for some reason, they keep running into each other. In this, because she's so famous, there's no way that he's going to get in the same space as her again. She has to kiss him spontaneously at that time and, like, encourage him to see her again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, that was one of the points in the movie where I thought to myself, I really don't know why this incredibly famous woman who could be with anybody and has been with anybody just thinks this guy is so delightful that I'm just gonna, like, snog him on his doorstep,
Brian,
when he's spilled, like, juice all over me.
Brian, you know as well as I do that when you're a very rich and powerful person, you can do whatever you want to people.
It does seem, on occasion, like Julia Roberts treats him rather callously,
yes,
considering that she's so much more powerful than he is and has more money and fame and all this kind of stuff. I actually find that one of the more interesting aspects of the movie, that, like, maybe that kiss that takes place in his kitchen is kind of an ill-advised and stupid thing for her to do that she sort of regrets because she's kind of leading on this sort of normal person.
So, you know, I think the power dynamic lies in the fact that she can do this kind of stuff, you know? She can seduce him because she has the leverage of fame to make the decisions. She leaves a message with Spike to tell Thacker that she's in the Ritz or something, and to come and see him. He finds out a day late, and he goes to see her. Well, he doesn't know that it's a junket, you know, that she's doing. And, like, she is a super famous actress. She's only ever going to be anywhere for a very short amount of time. But the fact that she has to see him at a junket kind of is totally believable. And he is desperate to be with her because she's famous.
Well, it puts great pressure on it. I have to say, this is like one of my favorite scenes in the movie, because Hugh Grant has showed up thinking he's going on a date, and then he has to quickly pretend to be a journalist from Horse and Hound. And not only does he have to be handled by all these handlers and PR people to interview her, he has to then go and interview all the other stars of this, you know, Galaxy Quest movie that she's in, that
he's
never seen and he knows nothing about.
I'm so sorry. I arrived outside. They thrust this thing into my hand. I didn't...
No, it's my fault. I thought this would all be over by now. I just wanted to sort of apologize for the kissing thing. I seriously don't know what came over me, and I just wanted to make sure that you were fine about it.
Yeah. Absolutely fine.
Do remember that Miss Scott is also keen to talk about her next project, which is shooting later in the summer.
Ah, yes.
Excellent.
Any horses in that one? Or hounds, for that matter. Our readers are equally intrigued by both species.
It takes place on a submarine.
That is one of the scenes where the obstacle of her fame is used to brilliant comic effect.
Yeah, agreed.
To kind of keep them from each other, even though they want to be together. It's then followed by kind of a set of parallel scenes where she joins him in his world,
yeah,
which is the kind of middle class, Northwest London.
It's totally Northwest London, isn't it?
Well, it's Notting Hill and but, surrounding okay. environs. Where else? Like Holland Park. Like,
oh my god.
What I find funny about this is that like Julia Roberts comes in, and of course all of Hugh's relatives and friends. It's his sister's birthday party, yeah. right? All of his relatives and friends immediately know who she is, but they do that British thing of not really talking about it, you yeah. know, until the sister comes in, and the sister is yet another kooky-haired person, yeah. another Richard Curtis type.
Yeah, she walks away and goes, oh my god, Anna Scott!
This is like the total Richard Curtis cast of characters, right? Because in every one of these movies, there's this like fluffy, frothy, romantic plotline that, you know, is quite unbelievable. And then there's, like, some aspects of, quote-unquote, real life
yeah.
And aspects of pain yeah. and trauma. Four weddings and a funeral.
Yeah.
So in this one, his best friends are these couple, kind of loving couple who face difficulty because the woman has paralyzed herself. She's in a wheelchair and she's yeah. also infertile. And it's a recent
yeah, she had an
situation,
accident.
Right? She's yeah. had an accident. So there's the two of them, there's the kooky sister, and then there's my favorite member of this group, which is Hugh Bonneville from Downton Abbey, who plays this like gormless kind of city trader who kind of just shows up and completely doesn't recognize who Julia Roberts is.
Yeah.
And he's saying things like, oh yes, I did a bit of amateur acting, you know, P.G. Woodhouse, that sort of thing. He was very funny, and he struck me as exactly the kind of person that we would run into at yeah. a party that we didn't want to be at.
Yes.
Probably in Northwest London. But I guess
ooh, burn.
It is a burn from the residents of Lambeth Pride. So anyway, I guess what I'm saying is, like, part of where the movie kind of loses me a little bit is, like, Julia Roberts staring around the table at everyone. And you can tell that we're meant to think that she's, that through her head is going, oh gosh, if only I lived this life like the normal people, having their birthday dinners together, not having to deal with the publicity. And it's like, these people are fine. They don't yeah. seem particularly exciting.
Well, isn't there one of those cliched scenes in which, like, a song plays over and the camera kind of slowly pans across the faces and they're all going ha 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 or deep in thought or like looking deep into each other's eyes or like putting their arms around each other and signifying how close they are and how ordinary they may remain.
And I think this is part of where the whole Julia Roberts' real life story is kind of coming into play. Like, we are meant to think that Anna Scott has had all these on-again, off-again relationships. She's been unlucky in love. She's been kind of in the public eye for such a long time. And we read into it everything that we know about Julia Roberts' own romantic troubles and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But do you want to talk about the brownie?
I bear in mind, I did pick this film as a good example of Julia Roberts, not necessarily the film. So there's a last brownie remaining, and whoever has the most miserable life gets the brownie.
Can I say, that is the most British parlor game to ever have been declared. Like,
aren't they awful?
Let's compete really? For misery?
Yeah.
I mean, you have
I've got a toilet in my house. I've got a bucket. I can throw out the window every day.
So you've got a woman in a wheelchair who's also infertile.
Yeah.
And so she kind of claims the brownie at first.
By default.
Then you have the city trader who's like, I have a soulless life making money at a job that I don't really like or know anything about. But then the coup de grace comes from Our Lady, the movie star, who's like, no, actually, the saddest life of all is me as the movie star.
I've been on a diet every day since I was 19, which basically means I've been hungry for a decade. I've had a series of not nice boyfriends, one of whom hit me. And every time I get my heart broken, the newspapers splash it about as though it's entertainment. And it's taken two rather painful operations to get me looking like this.
Really?
Really. Mm-hmm. And one day, not long from now, my looks will go. They will discover I can't act. And I will become some sad middle-aged woman who looks a bit like someone who was famous for a while.
No, nice try, gorgeous, but you don't fool anyone.
And I feel like this is yet another moment where we're meant to think, oh my God, this is so interesting because it's Julia Roberts talking about her own regrets of her fame and her success.
Yeah. So later that evening, when Hugh Grant is walking her home and they stumble into a park and he says, whoopsie daisies, and she mocks him, they get back to her hotel. And who opens the door? Only Alec Baldwin, who's playing her boyfriend, an obnoxious yank. So she has not told Thacker that she is dating anybody. Thacker is then misinterpreted as a bellhop by the awful American Alec Baldwin, who asks him to, like, take out the trash and take away these dirty dishes and bring us some room service and all this kind of stuff. And poor Hugh Grant is, understandably, quite, you know, upset by this. And he kind of slinks off, and he doesn't see her again, does he?
No, he goes through a period where he just doesn't want to talk to her, and she goes off and she returns to her movie star life. And, like, this is a really interesting dynamic because it's yet again a time where Julia Roberts, the movie star, is really callous with a, quote, normal person's feelings.
Yeah.
Maybe in the life of a movie star, she would expect everyone to know that she has an on-again, off-again relationship with some other movie star, the Alec Baldwin character. But, like, Hugh Grant doesn't read Hello Magazine. He's not really, you know, up to date on all this stuff. He's just a poor lonely guy with a broken heart, you know?
Yeah.
Julia goes off, she does her next film. I think she even wins an Oscar, and he's watching it all from afar.
Yeah, she wins an Oscar.
Yeah. And so the only thing that brings her back into his life is yet another scandal. Actress Anna Scott appears in porn films.
Oh, yeah. So basically, the best thing is that she explains it to him, in turn explaining it to us, so it becomes even vaguely believable, is that years ago she had art photos taken of her, but what she didn't know is that she was also being filmed, so there's video footage of her walking around with her clothes off, etc., etc.
Completely unbelievably, the only place that she can think of to hide away, to stay from the hounding of the press, is at his flat yet again, where this time their relationship goes even further. Their affair is rekindled. She kind of apologizes for her poor treatment of him.
Yeah, they perform coitus.
Yes, the coitus occurs.
Yeah.
And it's then that we're supposed to see Julia really dropping all her defenses as a movie star. They even have this discussion about the idea that people want to go to bed with Gilda and wake up with the real person.
Yeah.
You know, the famous line about Rita Hayworth.
Yeah.
Here's just my question, Sean. It's all very charming, and there's some witty lines, and it's all very well handled. Did you think there was a real romantic spark between Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant?
No, I did not.
So is that a flaw in the film?
Well, what the spark between them is that I believe they're quite good friends.
They get on really well, and they have fun banter. She, as an American counterweight to his foppishness, she is like 20,000 times better than Andie MacDowell in Four Weddings and a Funeral.
I mean, I would have dubbed Andie MacDowell back into Glenn Close's voice in that film if I had the chance.
You can barely imagine Hugh and Julia doing much together besides, like, having brunch and, like, saying some jokes.
Agreed. But is that, I mean, does that take away from the idea that they should be together? I'm not quite sure. I mean, I do think that as rom-coms go, Notting Hill is not the most rom of the comms.
No, it's more, interesting. It's like a rare orchid in the rom-com garden where you're like, can they make this premise work? This premise being that she's a big movie star. And Richard Curtis has to throw in yet another obstacle. This time the obstacle is that the press discovers that she's staying there at his house thanks to Spike, the
furry friend,
the dreadful roommate who has told them, and she gets pissed off with him, and she goes off again and leaves him.
Her publicist shows up and pulls her out of the building. I thought to myself, that would be an interesting wordless role to play. The publicist who just pulls Julia Roberts out of a home.
Well, the publicist is probably completely unhappy because she's already having to deal with this porn story, and now she's, you know, her...
On a Saturday.
Yeah, her charge is now, you know, shacking up with some nameless British nebbish who runs a travel bookshop. It's yet more fodder for Fleet Street and the Daily Mail.
Rupert Murdoch is just throwing money in the air.
Well, you know, casually. Hugh Grant has his own run-ins with the Daily Mail. Wasn't he one of the ones who got his phone hacked in that?
Yeah, that was News of the World.
News of the World. There you go. So that's what I'm saying is like, it's fascinating to me that Hugh has dealt with this almost as much as Julia, but has to play the person who knows nothing about it. As you said, it's on again, off again. One of my favorite parts where it nearly seems like it's going to come on again is when later on more time passes and he comes to visit her on a movie set. Mm-hmm. Now, they've already had a lot of discussion about how she plays certain kind of roles. You know, she's in action movies and space things and romantic comedies, but she's never done a period drama like a Henry James movie. Mm-hmm. And then she contacts him and lets him know that she's back in London doing a Henry James adaptation, which appears to be filmed in Hampstead Heath at Kenwood House. Now, I can't for the life of me figure out what Henry James novel this is supposed to
be. Babe, it's not a Henry James novel. They thought, what is a period piece film? Like, it's really big puffy dresses.
Okay? I really want to know, though, because,
wouldn't Henry James have had Empire Wastelands?
No, that's Jane Austen. Okay. The costuming is not quite right for a Henry James novel. And let's be honest, like, most of the major ones had already been made into a movie at that point, so, you know, it's clearly not the Bostonians.
Is it a rival Portrait of a Lady? Maybe exactly the same time.
Possibly. I mean, I'd like to think it's maybe the Princess Casamassima, if you ask me, you know, or perhaps the Figure in the Carpet or the Beast in the Jungle, but, you know, we'll never know.
We'll never know.
This was of great interest to me. I hope someone's written a scholarly monograph on this.
Babe, is someone crying out for you to do it?
I mean, the Merchant Ivory meta quality comes in here because her co-star is actually Samuel West, who you might remember as Leonard Bast from Howard's End.
Yes, I do.
Hugh actually overhears her speaking to Sam West and kind of insulting him or seeming to insult him as just some nobody that she knew from the past. And yet again, his heart is completely broken, and so he doesn't talk to her on the film set.
She's callous once again.
But in this case, she's not callous, right? So she comes back to the bookshop carrying an original Marc Chagall painting.
Wearing her most conservative cardigan yet.
Yes, she is essentially now stripped down to become not a movie star, but just a normal girl who owns a Marc Chagall masterpiece.
That's an interesting scene. I mean, I think the costuming for that scene is particularly interesting because she looks kind of frumpy, to be honest.
And here's the thing. There is a classic kind of rom-com structure, which is about domesticating a woman.
Yes.
Okay? Many Katharine Hepburn movies follow this, like The Philadelphia Story is one example. A woman is too high and powerful, she's kind of too full of herself or something, and she has to kind of be brought down to a certain level of emotional vulnerability.
Well, that's what screwball comedies do, isn't it?
In order for Julia to be ready for Hugh, it's like she's gotta lose all the aspects that make her royal and grand and bigger than him. She has to be brought down to his size, and she comes back into the shop, as you say, costumed in a totally different way, with a completely different attitude.
I have to go away today, but I wondered if I didn't, whether you might let me see you a little, or a lot, maybe. See if you could like me again.
But yesterday that actor asked you who I was, and you just dismissed me out of hand. I heard.
And says some lines that I suppose some people find to be really romantic, I found to be pretty turgid.
Yeah, well, this is the takeaway line from the film. You know, this is the, is it still raining, I hadn't noticed, from Four Weddings and a Funeral. So she comes into the bookshop where she says, I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love her. I put a question mark at the end of that by accident, sorry. Asking him to love her.
And Hugh still doesn't want his heart to be broken, and so he takes the Chagall. She goes away, it's like she's going to leave London, and then he has one of those rom-com last-minute change of heart where he runs to the Savoy this time, not the Ritz.
Yeah.
And
first of all, he runs with everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Remember this. So he tells all his friends, who conveniently happen to be in the same place at the same time. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to London, but getting all your friends in the one room in the space of 24 hours,
well, it does happen impossible. To be. It does happen to be their friend's restaurant, which is closing down. Which again shows you how middle class they are, that they have friends who own a restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the restaurant is closing down and they all decide to get in the car and drive to the Savoy. I think we clearly paid attention to the fact that they seem to be driving the wrong way on most of the streets, considering where Notting Hill is in relation to the Strand. Oh, yeah.
Why are they going that way?
Anyway, they get to the Savoy. He yet again poses as a journalist for Horse and Hound.
Yeah, but actually, the interesting way he gets in is that he's trying to get into the press conference. And his friend in the wheelchair comes in, and she goes, "He's with me." She's actually quite posh, we should point out. "He's with me," and the receptionist is like, "And you are?" She's like, "Writing an article about how London hotels treat people in wheelchairs." And that gets him in immediately.
Yeah.
Very good.
And of course, there's a clever thing where he asks some questions, posing as the journalist. She realizes that it's a profession that he actually does want to be with her.
Yeah.
And she says that she'll be staying in London indefinitely.
Indefinitely.
Now, interestingly, we see them hug. We never see them have a yet another romantic snog.
Nope.
And then we kind of jump forward and they're in the park, the communal gardens in Notting Hill. She's got a baby bump and they're on that bench. And that's what I mean. It just, like, it doesn't give us that, like, sexy romantic payoff that you kind of want it to have.
There's no kiss in the rain.
Because it is really more about the fame thing and less about the chemistry thing.
It's about putting them together in the first place. And not about the love that exists.
I would also say it's weirdly about how men of a certain type project onto movie stars.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it works because the Anna Scott Julia Roberts character is this kind of blank canvas that everybody puts their fantasies onto. And that is why Hugh stays interested in her for such a long time.
Yeah.
It's not so much because of what really happens between them. It's that he's like snogged and slept with the most famous woman in the world. And there's something a bit icky about that, I feel
like. Yeah, well, that's not the only icky thing in the film, Brian. You know, I gotta say, you've touched upon two things there. Ickiness and blankness, okay? So, you know, she is blank in the sense that we project whatever we think a movie star is supposed to be. But there's this scene where they're having dinner in a restaurant, and there's conveniently a group of men who are sitting behind her who are saying, "Anna Scott! Oh, she's gagging for it. Oh, she is such a slut. Her and Melinda Messenger, total sluts."
I actually I'm embellishing a little bit. Meg Ryan on Melinda Messenger.
Meg Ryan, she is gagging for it. Oh, and then she comes up and she, you know, she takes them down very brilliantly. It's quite funny. But the whole point of it is like, there's so many aspects of this film that are completely just kind of gross and yet unbelievable and blank. It's like, you do not look at Anna Scott and think, "Oh my god, what a slut," at all.
Well, maybe that's because by the point that she made the film, Julia Roberts is in her more mature phase, but people probably did talk about Julia Roberts that way when she was in her 20s and she was first coming on the scene, and she was known for her on-again, off-again affairs and things like that, you know? Like, and certainly people talk about Jennifer Lawrence that way, I'm sure, like lads out on a night drinking, you know, which is essentially what that scene is all about.
Yeah.
I kind of think, though, that, like, the way that the movie has this, like, funny logic is like, okay, you and I do this podcast where we talk about actresses all the time.
I mean, I just said earlier that Julia Roberts looks funny.
Okay, so what I'm saying is, let's imagine that we were just, you know, having a chat in the Wagamama on the South Bank. You know, we're talking about what we think of Meryl Streep, and then Dawn Gummer walks up to us and is like, "I hope you're happy. Meryl is sitting right next to you."
Like, we would go,
what I'm saying is,
that would be the best day ever.
When someone is uber famous, they shouldn't be upset about the fact that other people are sitting at a table in a restaurant talking about
them. Yeah, but they're saying pretty obnoxious things.
Yes, they are saying obnoxious things, and I'm not going to ever be in a restaurant talking about how bangable Meryl Streep is, but I might be talking about how I don't think she's particularly good in August and Osage County, and I don't need, you know, Dawn Gummer to then insult my dick size, which is what Anna Scott does in this film.
She was great in Doubt, you little cunt.
There's a kind of crazy logic to some of this stuff that you just have to buy in the kind of wacky world of this movie. I have a question for you, though, Sean. Given all the trials and tribulations that William Thacker and Anna Scott have had, like, the amount of times she's flaked out on him, the amount of times they've been hounded by the press, like, do you think this relationship will actually last? Like, if you were him, wouldn't you just keep the Chagall, sell it, get, like, you know, a fortune, open another bookshop.
Or make the one you have profitable.
Yeah, exactly. And then just end up with that other nice girl that you went on that date with, Tessa, who seemed perfectly lovely and a perfect match for a kind of middle-class Notting Hill bookshop owner.
Well, you know, he also got her pregnant, Anna Scott. Even if they do get divorced, I mean, he gets a huge payoff, I suppose, plus child support. So, isn't that enough? Your romance with the movie star, and now you have a baby together? And a big divorce settlement? It's not a bad day. It's not an unhappy ending.
No, I know. Divorce settlement, no, a Chagall.
She's the one who loses out, ultimately, because she is saddled with this weirdo. She's lost her Chagall, and she's given him 50% of her earnings.
We've just turned this lovely romantic movie into quite a cynical comment on fame and money.
Well, that's what it is.
Speaking of cynical comments on fame and money, we are going to move on to some other Julia Roberts movies in part two, which perhaps are even more cynical. But can we just wrap up, because I've been a little bit harsh on Notting Hill. I do think it is a good movie. Julia Roberts is giving a Star Waters performance. I'm interested to know from you on rewatching it, you know, what it made you think about or what conclusions you've drawn from it.
It made me realize that your point earlier, that it's not the most typical romantic comedy and that it is quite meta and it is more a study of, you know, romance between famous and non-famous people, and also kind of contextualizing Julia Roberts's fame in this role. I look at it differently. I think I kind of have a bit more respect for it. And I think if you watched it, you might get something out of this.
Like, does its commentary on stardom generally help us understand anything about Julia Roberts in particular?
That she's captivating. She's, more than anything else.
Yeah, she's totally captivating. She's the most beloved film star of my most beloved person, which is my Aunt Jerry, who will literally go to see any Julia Roberts movie. What's her favorite one, Sean?
Dying Young.
Sean hadn't even known that Julia Roberts was in a movie called Dying Young.
Dying Young.
Great title for a movie. We've seen two Julia Roberts movies with my Aunt Jerry.
Yeah.
One was
Money Monster.
Bad choice, but a wonderful choice.
Wonder.
Yeah. If any podcast listeners thought they might enjoy Wonder, which came out last year, in which Julia is a mother of a boy who has a facial disfigurement, played by Jacob Tremblay. Really, really go to see that movie. It is actually really good.
It's really good.
It's a family film, but it's a family film that has some really interesting issues and really interesting structure to it.
It's a film for the Obama generation.
It also has lovable mensch Mandy Patinkin presiding over a wonderful, multiracial, gentrified Brooklyn school. So what more could you want in the Trump era, you know? Yeah. Mandy in charge of everything.
I'd like if Barbara Streisand played a bag lady. That would have made the film a bit better. Deleted scenes, perhaps.
I think, actually, we saw that. It was called Nuts. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to move on to part two of Julia Roberts. We're going to go on a quest with Julia, globe-trotting around the world.
Yes.
You can find some teases of what that film is going to be at our Twitter page, which is @BroadAppealPod. I am @BAMullenSpeaks.
I'm @SeanMcGovernX, and we'll see you in the next episode.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
I can think of younger days when I lived for my life. Was everything a man could want to do. I could never see